KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Today on Speakers Forum, on the road to a future which promises steady advances in artificial intelligence, what should we expect? What should we be wary of or hopeful about? Our guide is Blaise Aguera y Arcas. He's a software designer currently working on machine intelligence for Google. As you'll hear, Aguera y Arcas is insightful and philosophical about the cross-sections of science and human culture in our past and future. His talk is titled, Time to Ring Some Changes, Machine Intelligence, Economic Dignity, and Gender. Blaise Aguera y Arcas spoke on July 26, 2014, as a participant in the 6th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium. Thanks to Smoke Farm, the Rubicon Foundation, Brendan Kiley, and Jason Evans for this recording. Please be advised, the following program contains some language of an adult nature.
Thank you so much. I was here as a civilian last year, and it was awesome. The idea of a sort of something kind of like TED, but run Marxist style for $15 in a farm was really appealing, and I'm really honored that Brendan and Stuart invited me to come up on stage this year. So I'm going to talk about three things today, about machine intelligence and economic dignity and gender, which are three things that might not seem like they go together particularly smoothly, so you be the judge of whether this looks like a dog's breakfast by the end. The reason that I went to Google from Microsoft about 6 months ago is because Larry Page made it clear that he really was dedicating Google to going after solving machine intelligence for real. The Guardian called it a Manhattan Project of AI a few months ago. And that's maybe a little bit of a dark way of putting it, but I think like nuclear physics, this is a technology that has both enormous positive and negative potential. And it's both very, very interesting intellectually to be engaged in something like that that seems so world-changing. And also, I think it's important for those of us who care about how those things happen to get close rather than to move away from where it's going on so that we can try and do it right. And so that's a large part of why I'm at Google now. I'm by no means a machine intelligence expert, but it is a little bit of a kind of return to some of the work that my wife Adrienne and I used to do many years ago on computational neuroscience, and it's been fun to have our fields sort of re-intersect in the way that they've started to. So very, very quick sort of four-line history of machine intelligence or artificial intelligence. The field, I think, really began in the 1950s with the first understanding of how human brains work. And neurons, and the discovery of the spike and the action potential. And at the beginning, a bunch of the scientists who were working on brains and also knew something about computers, which were also an emerging field around this time, had the insight that probably thinking is computing of some kind, and that maybe in a few years they could do what the brain does in a computer. And they were a little bit optimistic. And nothing much happened in the 50s, although a lot of very, very good ideas nucleated around this time. But computers were very, very weak. And so the amount of computation that could be done with them didn't even remotely approach what it would take to do anything brain-like. And also the computers were too weak to really experiment with what brain-like algorithms could even look like. So a lot of things that were called artificial intelligence in the decades that followed were not really attacking the problem from the point of view of brains or of what we know about how brains work, but from much more abstract principles. Can we think about natural language and reasoning? Can we model concepts as little you know, bits and bytes that can be manipulated using logic and symbolic algebras and so on. And that whole field made a certain amount of progress at things like computational algebra or expert systems. Those things are still used, but they don't really resemble what we do in our heads at all. And you know, there's no such thing as an expert system that is creative or that's able to understand metaphor or that really can use language properly or that can do anything even remotely like passing the Turing test, for example. Which, as flawed as it is, it is an interesting thing to think about. Can a machine fool a person over an extended dialogue into believing that it's a person? I don't think that's necessarily a good test of intelligence, but we're not even close. We certainly weren't even close throughout this whole period. And there have been AI winters that have sort of come between the bursts of progress throughout these last few decades, more or less one a decade, in which a lot of early promise, a lot of over-promising, resulted in a kind of boom and bust cycle, and everybody thought this was a bunch of crap. And then, you know, slowly research kind of started to pick up again. And now we are in a renaissance of this stuff, starting around 2006. A really remarkable and new AI summer, I suppose, has begun. And I didn't even really realize how important this one was until after coming to Google and seeing some of the things that have been happening there. I'm guessing probably about half of the really good machine intelligence researchers are, you know, at or working closely with the company now. But it's very much an international effort, and it's not one company's effort. There are a lot of academics working on this stuff now. And it's qualitatively different this time. And I think that a part of the reason that it's qualitatively different is that a lot of the approaches to machine intelligence now are not based on sort of hypotheses about how thought works, but neither are they based on a kind of literal aping of what neurons do, but they're somewhere in the middle. They really are looking at how intelligence emerges in natural systems and doing things that look similar to the way intelligence works in natural systems. I'll try and give you some examples and some reasons why this is possible now and hasn't been possible before. So if we think about the brain as a computer, and by the way, I'm in saying all of this, I'm dismissing the idea of a soul. All right, so I hope you're all, maybe some of you disagree, but I'm assuming that we are physical beings and that everything that we are is because of the way our matter is ordered. And that's not to say that there isn't something utterly magical and special about, you know, what it is to be human and to be intelligent. I just think that it's, in a way, a cop-out to talk about that as something other than the remarkableness of the way we are as physical things. So how complicated is a brain? Well, Hans Moravec in the 1990s, a famous roboticist, made some estimates of how complicated brains are, and he did it using really, really crude kind of engineering-y methods, but I think it's still an interesting way of thinking about it. So what he did is he looked at retina, which is really an outpost of brain, and you know, it's made up of neurons as well. And unlike the rest of the brain, we kind of know what the retina does. So it's meaningful to talk about how complicated a computer it would take to do the same operations that the retina does. So it's basically look for moving bars, moving edges. And so he made that kind of estimate and, you know, said, oh, well, that looks like it's about a megaflop, about a million operations per second. And then he said, well, the brain is 75,000 times heavier than the retina, so let's multiply the whole thing by 75,000. Right? And that's his estimate, which is 100 teraflops, 100 trillion operations per second is what he thinks the brain does. And he made a bunch of really cool plots that, in a way, relate Moore's law and relate the scaling of computational power over the decades with, you know, what that means in terms of brains. And, you know, these are the kind of, this is a little bit small, it doesn't reproduce super well, but, you know, it's computers of different makes and models are the red dots, and you can see that the y-axis here is exponential, so, you know, what looks like a straight line is actually an exponential improvement in capability over time, roughly 1,000-fold improvement in computation every decade. Right? That's what's been going on since the 1940s. And over here on the right-hand side, you see different kinds of critters. Right? And this is the complexity of different kinds of critters on that same scale. And that gives you a kind of crude guess as to when computers are going to be powerful enough to do what real brains do of different kinds. And, you know, as cheesy as this thing is, I think it's not that far off. I see it as a kind of lower bound. Now, there is an upper bound on the computational complexity of what a brain does, too. And these numbers are courtesy of Henry Markram, who has been involved in what I think is a not very scientifically sound project. Most neuroscientists agree with this in Europe, but it's got an enormous amount of funding to essentially simulate the brain down at the microscopic level of detail. So, you know, simulate the activity of every neuron and, you know, every current in every neuron. Most of us who know a little bit about how brains work don't believe that literalness is actually necessary in order to be able to replicate what a brain is actually doing. Also, we don't have enough information to be able to make such a model actually think or do anything useful that brains actually do. It's very under-constrained at the moment. But I think it still gives a useful upper bound. And Markram's number is an exaflop, which is 1,000 petaflops, which is 1,000 gigaflops, which is 1,000 teraflops, which is 1,000 megaflops, which is 1,000 kiloflops, which is 1,000 floating point operations per second. All right, so this is I think it's a quintillion floating point operations per second. So this is a lot more, but actually the difference between Moravec and Markram's bounds is only a factor of 10,000. And in years, that would be 13. All right, so it's a difference of 13 years, you know, plus or minus 7, call it. So we are going to have computers well within our lifetimes that are absolutely capable of computing at the same complexity, at the same level that the brain is. Now, it's not the case that you throw that many transistors into a computer and suddenly it wakes up or something, right? There are algorithms, there are things about how the brain is organized that we don't fully understand yet. But what has been the case, and I've come to appreciate this much more over the last 6 months, is that when a computer at desktop scale, so at the scale that a grad student can sit down and play with, sort of comes of age, when that kind of machine is powerful enough to do simulations at a certain scale, then those grad students kind of work out the tricks that allow fancy things to happen at that scale. So the algorithms and the capabilities seem to follow along, not far behind the computational capability, just because that's when you start to be able to play with it and figure it out. And I'll give you an example of what playing with it and figuring it out looks like. So this is Jeff Hinton, who really I see as the father of modern deep neural networks, as they're called. And he's working with Google quite closely these days. So in 2006, the first kinds of analyses that Hinton was working on were based on very, very simple kinds of stimuli. These are digits, 0 through 9. And the problem that these very, very simple machine intelligences were solving is how to map these 26 by 26 pixel grayscale images to the number 0 through 9. It's a simple problem that the post office has to solve when they read the zip code off of the back of an envelope. And the data sets to train these networks are basically a whole bunch of digits written by different people. And what Hinton did is he put together these neural nets that are quite brain-like, and trained them using training algorithms that look a little bit like what happens in brains during learning. And you end up with this kind of block diagram of virtual neurons connected to virtual neurons. And they learn. And what they learn at their bottommost layers, sort of early in this sensory processing machine, looks kind of like these ripple patterns, these sort of Dorito patterns. Are Doritos the ones those are the ones, ruffles? And this is and what's on the right here are similar kind of ruffle patterns measured in the brains of monkeys in early visual system. And this is a little bit kind of arm hair raising, because what you see is behaviors emerging in the early sensory processing of the machines and of real brains that look very, very similar. And then when you look higher up, and you start to present more sophisticated forms of these networks with more sophisticated stimuli, like natural scenes, images of things in the world, of this barn or of the field outside, they start to learn features that are higher and higher order and more sophisticated, and those also look a lot like the kinds of features that we actually observe when we stick electrodes into the brains of macaques and we stimulate them with images of natural scenes. So this this stuff where we begin to see, you know, behaviors emerge in the artificial systems like the way they emerge in natural systems, I think tells us that we're on the right track. We haven't cracked it, but as far as sensory processing, which is a good third of the brain, we're really getting there, I think. This is an iPhone app that uses a deep neural net of that sort, and you can aim it at stuff, and here somebody's aimed it at a bottle of wine, and it thinks it's a wine bottle and it's red wine. That's not the kind of vision task that computers were capable of doing 5 years ago. You know, and it takes a human who is, you know, a year old to be able to do tasks like that visually. And that's really interesting. And the progress has just been radical and dramatic and very, very fast in this field.
Coming up after a break, jobs at risk of being replaced by robots. Stay tuned for more of this talk by Blaise Aguera-Yarkas. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
It's 9:22, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Pennsylvania state legislators held a news conference on Tuesday to discuss a proposed hate crimes bill. At the news conference, State Senator Jim Furlow announced that he's gay. That story tonight at 11:45.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska Airlines, providing Seattleites with Northwest food and drink like regional craft beer and ales, spirits made on Capitol Hill, and cheese from Pike Place Market. More information at alaskaair.com.
Look for a low temperature in the 50s to low 60s tonight in Seattle. Showers likely. Chance of thunderstorms. Friday's high in the mid to upper 60s. Mostly cloudy on Friday with showers likely. Support for KUOW comes from Community Power Works, a home energy upgrade program for Seattle City Light customers. More about rebates, financing, and home energy audits at communitypowerworks.org.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Our guest today is Blaise Aguera-Yarkas. In his day job, he works on machine intelligence for Google. And curiously, he's the inspiration for a fictional character. Seattle writer Maria Semple based the character Elgin in her novel Where'd You Go, Bernadette? On Aguera-Yarkas. Coming up, are we creating the seeds of our own destruction?
In addition to things like sensory processing, one of the companies that Google acquired in this field, they've been on a little bit of a spree of acquiring machine intelligence companies lately, was called DeepMind, and that's based in London. And they have built a machine that plays Atari 2600 games. So this one is not just a sensory processor, but a whole feedback loop that involves looking at the screen. It looks at the pixels on the screen, and it has access to the controller of the video game device, and it knows what the score is. And based on just that, it's able to learn how to play a wide, wide range of Atari 2600 video games over the course of a couple of days of playing. And in many cases, it's able to achieve superhuman capability in those games. And the really remarkable thing is that I'm not talking about a system that's been specialized to any particular game. It's the same thing. And you put one game in front of it, it learns that one, or you put another game in front of it, it learns that one. And so this is goosebump-raising kind of stuff. And this is where we are now. So before I move on to the second part, I know that I'm going to run a little bit long. Apologies. I want to just take a pause and say that machine intelligence is not life. And this is, I think, one of the common misconceptions that when we start thinking about some of the negative potentials really comes up early. You know, is this going to turn into Skynet? You know, are we going to make things that are like us in these fundamental ways, that have led to, for example, more technologically sophisticated humans when they encounter less technologically sophisticated humans wiping them out, say, in Tasmania or in the Americas? Are we creating the seeds of our own destruction with exactly the same pattern via these things that we create? I think the answer is not necessarily yes. Not necessarily yes. And the reason is that we should keep in mind that intelligence, as we understand it, is a very recent adaptation in our evolutionary path. You know, I see it as sort of like the opposable thumb. It's a recent thing, the past million years, perhaps. And life is vastly older than that. And when you look at even at all the older regions of the brain that are not about the cerebral cortex and, you know, reasoning and thinking and so on, a lot of that stuff down there is ancient, and that's where emotion comes from. That's where motivation comes from. That's where the desire for power comes from. Sex, hunger, the urge to dominate other beings, even the urge to stay alive, self-preservation. It comes from those very low-down things. I mean, you can poke at a beetle with a stick that has, you know, no real ability to think, and it has all of those things. You know, it'll scurry around if it feels threatened and so on. And those things don't emerge somehow from intelligence. It's the other way around. Intelligence exists on top of those more primitive things. So us building intelligence does not mean that, you know, we're going to, like, the thing is going to turn around and say, okay, now I want you all dead because I want to survive. We would actually have to build that emotional system in order for that to be the case. In just the same way that the DeepMind Atari 2600 playing robot is wired up to the score. So we gave that intelligence and emotional system tied to the score of the video game. It likes high score. It doesn't like when the score stays constant or decreases or whatever. And that's what it plays for. We get to decide what the score functions are. They could be about human happiness. They could be about harmony. They could be about world peace. Or they could be weaponized. And we really have complete freedom, I believe, as to what we make those score functions. And in that sense, like every kind of technology, it's double-edged. It can be put to good use or to bad use, and all of it depends on what the score function is, what's the emotional system that we wire those intelligences to when we make them. So, you know, we're like, we're in our adolescence, and we're acquiring these powers that are unprecedented. And, you know, like with a kid learning to drive a car for the first time, you know, this is empowering, but it's also a weapon. And that really depends on how it's used. One more thing that I should say about machine intelligence is that this really leaves wide open the question of personhood. You know, we have just kind of decided ourselves that something that looks like a human body has some rights that, you know, that we call personhood. It has, you know, there are human rights, there are civil rights. And this is just a decision that we've made for, you know, maybe emotional reasons. But if you really look at people, at humans with bodies, you find a wide, wide range of different kinds of deficits or, you know, capabilities, non-capabilities. You find people who lack sensory systems. You find people who are paralyzed. You find people who lack theory of mind. You find people who are near vegetative. You find people who are autistic, you know, all along the spectrum. And we've just decided these are all people. And I think that makes sense. But, you know, we're going to make these systems that have or don't have all kinds of different systems and capabilities in just the same way. And we're going to be confronted with the question of if and when we think about those as being persons. And I don't think that there is an answer to that question. I mean, I think this is in some sense it's an aesthetic judgment that we're going to have to make. What do we want to think about as being personhood, and what does that mean about what and who we are? No answer there. I think there fundamentally is no answer there. Let's talk now about the effect on employment. So if you type jobs at risk of being replaced by robots into Google, then you find lots and lots of hits, and I'm sure that many of you have seen this kind of stuff before. The Atlantic did a piece in January, you know, which jobs will the robots take? And, you know, there have been serious academics who have tried to actually ask this question, you know, what are the jobs that are most at risk and why? And, you know, it's kind of all of them. That's the problem. I think that there are some that are safer than others. I think that, you know, customer service for fancy things, sex work, you know, these things are probably going to be human for a long time. You know, we're not just talking about factory jobs. You know, many of you have probably heard, for example, that Watson, the Jeopardy-playing robot that IBM made a while ago, can do a pretty damn good job of playing doctor. And, in fact, you know, I think better than most human doctors. I think, ironically, nurses will last much longer than doctors will as credible human professions. So So, you know, this isn't new. I mean, we used to all be hunters and gatherers, and then that became obsolete. And then, you know, 90-some percent of us were farmers, and now 1% of us are farmers, because all those jobs have gone to tractors and to other kinds of technology. And this is more of the same, but it's happening faster and faster, and it's taking over more and more of what we think of as being, this is what humans do well. Oh, no, well, maybe it's this. And we move up the chain, but there are limits to how far up we can move up the chain, I think. And so that leads to questions like this one. My friend Jaron Lanier wrote this book a little while ago, Who Owns the Future? The previous book was You Are Not a Gadget, so you can see some of his politics emerging in the titles of his books. He really is not a believer in machine intelligence. And so he thinks that, you know, there will always be humans, lots of them, who provide the data that makes the network realization of any technology better and cheaper, and that maybe you can make an economy around, I don't know, likes and, you know, Facebook posts that somehow salvages the middle class. But I kind of think this is bullshit. If we're making intelligent systems, at some point they'll know enough about human tastes that we're not going to need, you know, like a continual stream of likes in order for them to figure it out. So tech means increasing capability at decreasing cost. And, it's hard for me to see a future in which if we continue the way that we have, with the assumption that a basic standard of living requires that we be economically productive individually, that path seems like it leads to the vast majority of us becoming, gods, in the sense that we have all this incredible capability, but broke, in the sense that we can't afford a roof over our heads. It, of course, leads to an increasing inequality in wealth between the people who build and control the systems that are doing the work, the technology, and everybody whose work is being eliminated by that technology becoming very good. So, I think this is just kind of an inevitability, and I think the problem is not with technology, but with Calvinism, and with this assumption that a standard of living and economic productivity should be tightly coupled. I think we're reaching the end of the period where this makes sense. There have been experiments in other ways of doing things. The Mincom experiment in Canada was one such. There have been experiments in the U.S. as well. And the basic idea is very, very simple. It's just, you know, if you're doing these things, if you have this big economic surplus, then just redistribute it in such a way that everybody has the basics, or maybe more than the basics. There are countries in Scandinavia that are doing this. Norway is coming very, very close to doing this now. And I don't think that this is a political issue. I think this is just pragmatic. There will come a point when we have no choice but to do that. Capitalism can survive on top of a system like that, I think. But the floor has to be socialist. I don't see any other solution. That's just, you know, my opinion, I suppose. That increasing economic inequality, because of the technological cycle, is evident when you look at things like the rise in Gini coefficients in different countries over the past 20 years. All right, so many of you probably know the Gini coefficient is a number that measures how equally distributed wealth is in a society. A Gini coefficient of 0 would mean everybody's got the same, and a Gini coefficient of 1 would mean that one person has all the money and everybody else has 0. And what this is showing you is that between the mid-1980s and the late 2000s, virtually all of the OECD countries had their Gini coefficients go up on average, except for Turkey and Greece, which had their own issues during this period. So, very unequal societies like Mexico went up from 0.45 to 0.475. Very egalitarian societies like Sweden had their Gini coefficient go up by even more. So the idea that inequality is a political issue and it's based on the politics and the policies of particular countries, I think, is incorrect. It's going up everywhere, and it's going up everywhere because of this fundamental thing that's happening with technology. So this is another breakdown of the changes in income in 9 different OECD countries. It's not a great plot. It's from an OECD report, and it doesn't reproduce super well, but what I'm showing you here is P10, so the left-hand bars are the bottom 10% of income in the country, and P90 is the top 10% of income in the country. So the y-axis is average annualized percent increase in income between the mid-1980s and 2008. And then furthermore, it's broken down by men and women. So men are dark blue and women are light blue. So there are two features that you should be seeing in these 9 plots. One of them is that the slopes tend to be all positive except for Finland. And what that means is that people at the top have gained more year on year than people at the bottom. And the other thing is that women are doing better than men in terms of gains across the board. And those are both really interesting features. Let's zoom in on the US and you can see those very dramatically. The bottom half of men have lost money in income over the past 20 years, and the top half have gained. But women have gained across the board, and the top 10% of women earners have gained twice as much as the top 10% of men. Let's look at that broken down by education. Sorry, I know this is going too slowly. I'll try and speed up. When we look at the U.S. population, 25 and older, we go back to 1940, you see that college education was a very small fraction of the population. Right? So most people had only grade school or high school educations. Most had grade school educations, right? Not even high school. And now, more than half of the U.S. population has a college education, and that's growing. And if we look at that from 1979 to present, and we rescale these numbers by income, you see that people with college educations make a lot more money than people with high school and grade school educations. And if Bill Gates weren't in this one, then it would be even more dramatic. The reason, of course, is that as people move up the food chain, as people do more and more sophisticated tasks for their economic productivity, they need more and more education in order to do those tasks. So you see that, you know, more and more people are going to college and have higher educations, and also that their economic productivity outstrips those of people with less education, accentuating that effect. Now, this is number of college-educated men and number of college-educated women broken out separately from 1979 to present. And you can see that, so that the circles are data, and then I just drew lines through them. I mean, I don't like to extrapolate too much, but it's hard to resist extrapolating through those particular data points. You can see that the number of college-educated women exceeded the number of college-educated men in the early 90s. And these slopes are different. The number of college-educated women is growing faster than the number of college-educated men. And that's interesting, economically. That's true of every kind of degree. If you look at, so this is percent of graduates who are female with different kinds of degrees, you can see that early on, bachelor's and associate's degrees started to be dominated by women in the U.S., and later on, doctorates and JDs and so on. But they're all now more than 50% women in graduating classes. And this is like a peek into the future, because graduating class, of course, kind of trickles on to become an overall effect in the society. So these all look like they're trending toward 60% graduating rates of female, which means that eventually when things kind of settle out, 60% of the graduates will be female. Here's another very, very important piece of data. So I've shown you some stuff about growth in income, but I haven't told you about actual amount of income. And we all know that women were paid crap on the dollar relative to men for the same jobs if we go back to, say, the 1970s. And so this is a very busy plot. I'm going to step through these data in a nicer way in just a moment. But what I'm showing you here is women's income as a percentage of men's income as a function of year going from 1979 to 2012, and also as a function of age. So there are a bunch of data here for different ages of women. So the circles are the data points, the curves are my own fits through the data points, and I'm going to step now through the fits. This is if you're a 50-year-old woman. All right, so a 50-year-old woman in 1979 made 56% of what a man made full-time employed in 1979. But we go to 2012, she's making more than 75% of what a man is making. So things have improved. They still suck, but they've improved a lot. Now let's look at younger women. 49, 48, 47, 46. All right, so these are younger and younger women, and you can see that this curve is going up and up and up and up and up and up until we get to 21, and then it craps out and it flattens. So maybe there's a 90% ceiling in women's wage relative to men's, but actually not. Because remember that this is ages 16 to 21, that's when people are in college. All right, so what you're seeing here is the effect of people who don't have the relevant education, and there are particular kinds of jobs that less educated men and women are in full-time when they're employed during those ages. It tends to be more nanny-type stuff if you're a woman, tends to be more construction work-type stuff if you're a man. Both of those don't have much growth potential later on. So really it's the 22 to 35 curve that is the interesting one and that gives you the prediction of the future. And that one, so 25 to 34 years old, it just looks like it's going straight up. And You know, again, I don't like to extrapolate too much, but it shows no signs of slowing down. And what it suggests to me is that women's income is actually going to surpass men's income sometime in the next few years, maybe by 2020. So that's a really interesting story, and it's very, very different from what we think about as the gender gap in income. Even if you're very conservative with respect to what this means, and you say, well, women only make 90% of what men make, if 60% of them are going to college, that is, if 60% of college graduates are women, that still means that they have 135% of the buying power that men have. And if you assume that they reach equality, they have 150% of the buying power that men have. So women are about to have the economic power in this country, and the same data, by the way, are true in most parts of the world. This is not only a U.S. effect. I've shown you U.S. data. The data are similar in Europe, and they're similar in Asia. So this is an inversion of at least 10,000 years of history. It's been the case historically that women were first property and then second-class citizens and then an oppressed class. And now they're about to dominate men economically.
Stay tuned for more of this talk by software designer Blaise Aguera-Yarkas. Coming up, surprising testosterone research. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
942, KUOW 94.9. I'm Jack Walters. Thanks for being with us. Songwriter Neil Sedaka talks about his 50-plus years in show business. That's tonight at 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the EMILY program, providing personalized help for adults and adolescents suffering from eating disorders, including binge eating disorder, anorexia, and bulimia. More information and help is available by calling 1-888-EMILY-77.
Did you know you can search KUOW's website? You can look for a story you missed, the name of a city or town, an author's name, anything you need to find. Just go to kuow.org and look for the custom search box.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller with 9 locations that offer thousands of new and used titles, Husky gear, and gift items. Learn more about upcoming author events and store locations at ubookstore.com.
Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Here, our guest Blaise Aguera-Yarkas continues his explanation of how historical gender norms are changing and why. Then fields questions from the Smoke Farm audience.
Other people have noticed this. Hannah Rosin noticed this in her book, The End of Men. Why? Why is this happening? So, I at least have a theory about why this is so. I'm sure that it's controversial. But my hypothesis about why this is happening, why women are now poised to overturn 10,000 years of history and become economically dominant over men on average, is that it's connected with the technological cycle that we've been talking about, with the rising technology, economic growth, rising education, and urbanization, the concentration of people into cities that makes all of that possible. I think that those things result in a bias that that inverts the way genders are favored or selected for relative to the historical norm, which is that men are favored over women. The reason that men have been favored over women historically is because they're bigger and stronger. And, no matter how brilliant or spunky or whatever, a woman is when she is 15 in a hunter-gatherer society, if a man comes and beats the hell out of her and says, you're my property now, then if she's physically weaker, there's not much that she can do. And that difference in physical strength is important in early societies, and it becomes a lot less important as societies become urbanized. So Steven Pinker has talked about similar kinds of things in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. He doesn't really make the connection with gender, but he basically made a thesis about why violence overall has declined in societies over time. And that decline in violence overall in history is very, very well documented. Essentially, if you were born in 1900, your likelihood of dying violently was much less than if you were born in 1700, which in turn was much less than if you were born in the year 1000. And 1900 was still much more dangerous than if you're born in the year 2000. Your likelihood of dying a violent death is extremely low. Why? Because the environment has changed. As things urbanize, you have an environment in which there is more of a government monopoly on violence, more government authority, more interconnectivity of cultures through the need for trade, increased literacy, increased urbanization, increased mobility, increased sizes of working groups. And all of those things mean that physical strength is no longer determinant of your advantage. And it also means that that the role of physical dominance in society decreases. So we know that testosterone is the main difference between men and women biologically, level of testosterone. This is kind of the main sex hormone. And we have pretty good ideas about what it does. There are a variety of different kinds of experiments that relate testosterone level in the blood with behavior. There's one especially elegant one from 2009 in which 25 male subjects are asked to play a game that has both competitive and collaborative modes of win. And the level of testosterone in the blood is modulated artificially. And you can just flip them like a switch, you know, from a competitive mode of play at high testosterone to a collaborative mode of play at low testosterone. It's almost like a prisoner's dilemma type game. So we understand how this hormone works, and we know that it's many times higher in men than in women. And I think that there are a lot of measurable correlates of the change in selection bias from more aggressive to more collaborative. One can find that, for example, in want ads from newspapers. I did a little quantitative study. It's not very scientific or very rigorous, but looking at newspaperarchive.com, which has done OCR, optical character recognition, on newspapers going all the way back to the 1700s, you can search for words and phrases in job wanted postings over time. And, you know, this is typical of a 1962 want ad. Aggressive men, experience not necessary, you know, salesman wanted, and so on. And a typical ad from 2011 is great opportunity to join a collaborative team as a building maintenance assistant, team-oriented leadership style, emphasizing collaborative decision-making, well-developed interpersonal skills, excellent communication, and so on. So you see that there is a difference in the way the genders are suited to those two kinds of jobs. This is just a count of job wanted aggressive in red versus job wanted collaborative in blue in those job wanted ads from 1900 to 2000 by decade. I've normalized them to the max, so you know the absolute numbers are different, but you see this very clear pattern in which aggressive is becoming very unfashionable and collaborative is going way up. And you can run this kind of experiment for other kinds of word pairs that are similar and see the same results. We also see that testosterone levels in men are in decline. This article made a bit of a stir a few years ago. It showed that even correcting for age, levels of serum testosterone in men have declined. They're now about 70% of what they were in the 1960s, 1970s. And, you know, there's been a lot of ink spilled about why this might be. You know, some people talk about plastics in the environment, feminizing effects of ester diols, whatever. Maybe. But I tend to think that this is more like calluses. You know, we know, at least in the short term, that when testosterone is needed, when you're in fight and flight mode, when you're rugged, when you're living outside, when you require your strength and your individuality and so on, that testosterone levels rise. And I think that there is probably a long-term effect of those kinds of short-term modulations as well, and it's just not as much in demand now. And I think that that's why it's lower. So I think it's an environmental response. Again, not the only one who has noticed this. This is a right-wing blogger, Davis M.J. Aurini. Trained as a historian at McMaster University and as an infantry soldier in the Canadian Forces, I'm an author, a strategist, a neo-reactionary monarchist, and an entrepreneur. I won't say anything further about what I think he is. But on his... on his blog, he says, while I dislike using profanity, there's simply no better way to put it. There's an incredible amount of faggotry in modern society. A noun, overly theatrical, whiny, effeminate behavior, see faggotronics. Whiners, sensates, manboys, excuse makers, snowflakes, they abound, weak-jawed and weak-willed. Men who white knight around and allow women to walk all over them. Men who tolerate, even endorse, feminism. who thus fail to make women feel secure, let alone make them feel like a real woman, both allowing and driving them to seek the protection of government socialism. Men who vote socialist themselves, begging the government to take their guns away. A pop culture of effeminate pretty boys spawning a culture where you can put on a pair of women's jeans crushing your testicles without immediately getting your ass kicked. Not to mention a corporate and educational culture which is profoundly anti-masculine and effeminate. All right, so I think that Aurini is kind of right. You know, I guess that's kind of what I'm saying. We have different, you know, different emotional reactions to this, but I think he's kind of got a point. So my final thoughts: I don't think that the rise of women equals dominance over men. I think this is one of the ways in which people like Aurini have it a little bit backwards. One of the things that testosterone does is it promotes a dominance hierarchy way of thinking. In fact, it's very closely connected with dominance hierarchies in many, many animals. And low testosterone doesn't just mean lower place in the totem pole. It actually means not caring as much about the totem pole and not thinking about that as the organizing factor in society. So somebody with high testosterone looks at something like this happening, I think, and reads it as a loss in dominance. But if you're on the other side, then this actually looks like a loss in dominance hierarchies, period. And I think that that's, you know, in many ways very, very healthy. But many men aren't going quietly. And I think that the war on women and that coupling of all of these different social and political correlates, whether it's about socialism, about guns, women's reproductive rights and women's rights over their bodies in general. The coupling of all of those things together, I think, is not a coincidence. And I think that it's a reaction to what many people sense is this inversion in dominance in society or in the important role in society economically. Thank you. So the question is, how do you connect talk A and talk B? So somebody noticed at least that this was really two talks smashed into one. Although they are, I think they are connected in a lot of different ways. One of them, of course, is that if we imbue our artificial intelligences with things like dominance hierarchies, we're right, and it would not be wise of us to do that. That's one thing. Another thing is, and by the way, this also is connected with the problem of tech being so male dominated. Right, so there's something to be very aware of and thoughtful about there. Another connection is, of course, that one of these things that, say, Aurini is railing against is socialism. So a lot of the dominance hierarchy idea also rests on the idea that fitness is about these zero-sum games in which people compete in the marketplace for economic output, and there are winners and there are losers. And, the people who think that way are like running away from a tsunami that's going to engulf them as advanced technology and machine intelligence and so on. On the one hand, you know, if you look at it optimistically, provide plenty for all, or if you look at it pessimistically, take away everybody's jobs. So there are a lot of rich relationships between these issues of the way society changes, the way the gender selection changes, and the way that the accelerating technology changes the economic landscape. Okay, so yeah, I think there are a few sub-questions. One of them is, what's the point? Is this a good idea to be doing at all? Another is, are we morally equipped to deal with what we're making now? A third is, are moral philosophers or people who think about moral questions involved in this stuff at all? How is that actually working in practice? I think, right? Is that an accurate? So with respect to the first one, I don't like to think like a technological determinist. Like, oh, this is all happening. It's all happening anyway. Like, I hate when people say things like, privacy is so yesterday, it's already gone, there's nothing to do about it. Well, no, we're making these things. We get to decide. Like, let's step forward and own our decision rather than saying that somehow technology wants something. I hated that book, What Technology Wants, that came out a few years ago. It doesn't want anything. We make this stuff. So I do think that we have a lot of choices. On the other hand, it's also a positive feedback cycle that, you know, as it's like surfing, you know, you surf and the wave goes and you can't stay back because the wave is going as well. You get to guide it, but you don't get to stop it. And in that sense, I think we have a responsibility to step forward and to guide it and to neither be fatalistic or to have a kind of futility about it, nor to be kind of reactionary and Luddite about it. I think those two are non-choices. Is it good? I don't know. I mean, in some sense, I think that everything that we do is good and beautiful because this is what, you know, being human is about. We make things, we design, we make art, we make poetry, we make technology. This is the game. This is what it's about to be us. Is it happening too fast? Maybe. You know, maybe it's happening too fast. Maybe we're not equipped. But I think this is the challenge for us. Now, moral philosophers, in my experience, are very far removed from the realities of what is actually happening on the ground. I see a lot of, you know, kind of very disconnected academic work on moral philosophy, think tanks, institutes, and then engineers actually getting the stuff done. And there's a lack of connection between the two. And I think the fault is on both sides. And I don't necessarily think that the people who have taken it on as their jobs to think about this stuff are necessarily wiser either. So, you know, I don't know if that's an answer, but that's my feeling. Elliot. Sorry, that's cheating.
Do we need artificial intelligence, or do we want it, or do we feel that the that it's a good idea?
Yeah. So, do we need AI? Do we want AI? Is it a good idea? I mean, similar question in a way to the previous one. I think that it is a good idea in the sense that, you know, again, it's a flowering of what we are and what we do, and I think we should explore where that flowering leads. At the same time, you know, like with every new capability, like with every new power that we acquire, it's dangerous, and if we're not wise, then we face, you know, possible extinction. And I bring this back to sort of you and Anselm are going to learn how to drive soon, and every parent is afraid when their children learn how to drive and there's a possibility that you'll die. But that doesn't mean that I don't want you to go and get a driver's license, right? I'd like you to do it. Of course, it'll be even better when robots are driving cars, but that's all right. Thank you all so much.
Luis Aguera Yarkas is an inventor and software designer currently working on machine intelligence for Google. In his previous work as an engineer at Microsoft, his focus included augmented reality, Bing Maps and Bing Mobile, wearable computing, and natural user interfaces. His talk was titled, Time to Ring Some Changes, Machine Intelligence, Economic Dignity, and Gender. Blaise Aguera Yarkas spoke on July 26, 2014, as a participant in the 6th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium near Arlington, Washington. Thanks to Smoke Farm, the Rubicon Foundation, Brendan Kiley, and Jason Evans for this recording. If you enjoyed tonight's talk, you'll find it and many more on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. We post each new episode on the Friday following the broadcast. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 949 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
KUOW 949 Seattle, news and information. The three largest soda companies pledged to cut the number of calories in their sugary drinks, but there are new concerns about artificial sweeteners. We'll get the latest on the fight against obesity tonight at midnight. And here's what's coming your way tomorrow night at this same time.
Next time on LA Theater Works, a young scientist is on the verge of a breakthrough.
I think I may have figured out how to cure cancer.
And is entangled in the high-stakes world of science.
I need you, William. This is what I've been chasing for years.
Secret Order, starring Richard Schiff and George Segal. Next time on LA Theater Works.
You can hear that tomorrow night at this same time, Friday evening at 10 p.m. on KUW 94.9 FM.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.